Ivan Illich was born in Vienna in 1926 of Dalmatian and German parents. During the 1930s, he was expelled from his Austrian school because of his mother's Jewish background. He continued his education thereafter in Italy and studied crystallography at the University of Florence. He developed there a method of discerning blood types by their structure. And thereafter, he took a doctorate in history from Salzburg. He entered theological studies and prepared for the priesthood after that time and was ordained in Rome in 1952. He left the promise of a distinguished church career to do pastoral work in New York. And he went at that time to Incarnation Church in Washington Heights, a church serving a largely conservative Irish community, but with a growing influx of Puerto Rican persons. When Illich served in this capacity, the pastor of the church insisted on calling him Johnny Illich because of the implication of his name might be perhaps too Russian or communist for his parishioners. At that time, a remarkable relationship developed between Illich and Cardinal Spellman of New York, a Catholic traditionalist and an activist intellectual. The frequent disagreements between the two did not diminish the nature of the relationship, which is indicated in a comment which Spellman made in speaking to Illich, where he said, "So you know better than the Archbishop of New York." And he would say with a smile, "Well, you'd better be right. You'd better succeed." And this relationship between Cardinal Spellman and Illich continued throughout the controversial role which Illich has played in the church and outside it, and continued until the time of Cardinal Spellman's death. In 1956, Illich moved to Puerto Rico and there continued his work. Among other things at that time, he opposed the Catholic Party of Puerto Rico, which was campaigning at that time against birth control, using, as Illich has observed ironically, a banner which was decorated with a crucifix and a rosary. He developed there his ideas of new kinds of missionary training for priests to serve in Latin America, and founded thereafter, of course, his training school in Cuernavaca under the auspices of the Bishop of Cuernavaca. The prime aim of the center, of course, was the de-Yankification of priests who were to work in Latin America. In 1961, CIDOC, the Center for Intercultural Documentation, was established. It has been described as part language school, part conference center, part free university. It has developed into a center for social, political, and educational criticism, and has been described as follows. Its atmosphere of rarefied scholarship evokes the style of the great medieval monasteries, where laymen came to steep themselves in study in learned dialogues. And yet CIDOC's super efficiency, the impeccable institutional courtesy of its staff members, and the dazed expression on the faces of young Americans in the process of cultural transformation also suggest a very modern and luxurious private clinic. In 1968, he was called before the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith in the Vatican, an institution which is described as an offshoot of the Sacred Congregation of the Universal Inquisition, and was called to answer questions about his dangerous doctrinal views and about his bizarre conceptions of the clergy. Following that, he withdrew from what he calls the church as it, but reaffirmed his resolve to remain in the church as she. His views, perhaps, are best expressed in his own statement as follows. "I would like to help people smile. Smile the social system apart," he says. "Here at CDOC, we smile violence apart. It is a place where violent people can come and learn el respeto para la vida. Real revolutionaries are men who look with a deep sense of humor, with sarcasm upon their institutions. Sarcasm is adult playfulness. Cynicism is its opposite. Instead of freedom and independence, cynicism produces not real revolution, but a regressive attachment to slogans and self-worship. For deadly serious revolutionaries, no, merci. But sarcasm is essential to purify us of our illusions. It is with pleasure that I introduce to you Ivan Illich."
It is a rather uncomfortable experience to speak to you here and know that there are two more rooms full of people upstairs to whom I'm speaking through a TV screen. As much as I like to be a modern man, it somehow disturbs me very profoundly. So I went up there and asked the people upstairs what I should speak about this evening. And lots of them told me, "What you have written, we know. So I can't very well speak about what I know, because what I know, I write." So I want to tell Mr. Bruce Rusk, who has invited me, that he will have his manuscript for publication in a series for which he is responsible. But I will take the freedom of speaking freely to you, principally answering the questions of those who are voiceless here, because through your apparatus there, they are, and your sprinkling system, they get, which is called a network, well, it is really just a funnel. My opinions and thoughts can be funneled to them without any real opportunity of a dialogue. And then, as soon as possible, as soon as I have answered them, we can begin a dialogue around here. I hope you do not mind, therefore, that instead of presenting a carefully reasoned and fluent presentation, I just begin with about 10 minutes of some pieces which I've taken out of the manuscript which I prepared for this evening, making sure that there be as far as possible nothing in it which I've ever written anywhere else, because I write very little, so that nobody has to hear me twice. Then answer the questions asked from upstairs, be through this whole procedure in about, hopefully, 30 minutes, and we can, or 35 minutes, and we can start into a conversation right here. Schools, I assume, many of us are agreed, are losing their claim to a monopoly on formal education. They are moving off the center of the stage. The imminent bankruptcy of schools, or their inability to live up to their promise, forces the educator and the client to look beyond their mutual frustration with each other and the lack of resources they get, and recognize that school kind of has gone, I don't know how I should put it, the way of those saurians when the mammals arose. Within the next few years, it is pretty clear that both the purveyors and the consumers of packaged education will have to acquiesce to the end of the age of schooling, where other ages ended, the established church ended, the age of royalty ended. Of course, you could maintain schools in the way in which I think Canada is still a monarch, or belongs to monarchy, you know. In that sense, school will be present with us for a long time. School teachers will have to accept a fate similar to that which befell priests and nobles in other times.
Post-scholastic consciousness is bound to appear all of a sudden. I think it will appear unexpected as the changes happen in a whirlpool.
I remember as a child standing on a bridge and always waiting, once I'll be the witness how the whirlpool, the vortex pattern changes. I never saw it. Because winter and summer they are alike, but when one stone falls into the basin and the whole pattern changes from one moment to another, this is the way how one falls in love, or how consciousness changes, also social consciousness.
I believe it to come surprising as the removal of the altar or the throne happened from the center of the stage in Western society. The vision of an emerging pattern, whatever it is, threatens the reality of today. Especially when this emergent pattern is destined to become the common sense of tomorrow. The facts we now know about education fit the vision of a society in which the school system is certainly out of control, of central control, of purposeful education. What we now call the crisis in education is mostly a result of an effort to make the facts of life as we live them fit into our dogma that schools are necessary, mainly because the poor ought to be put into schools. Because we believe that people will not find time and motivation to learn unless we are either bribed or compelled. And the more we are liberals and concerned with other people, the more we are convinced that the poorer a person is, the more he must be bribed or compelled to submit to our educational treatment. I do believe that society can be de-schooled. That is, that we can look at what happens at this moment in society, fitting it into the pattern of something which doesn't fit the ideology which is prevalent. Therefore, the aim at de-schooling society must not be confused with two trends which are critical of the school system and which, though opposed, only seek to substitute school. And this I want to state very clearly at the beginning, especially because some of the people whom I spoke up there and in here in this room said, speak about new, independent, free schools. Let me call the first trend of those who want simply to substitute schools the Jacobines, and the second one, the Bourbons. The Jacobine educator, if I speak less loud, do you still hear me everywhere? This machine cannot be put up a little bit more so that I don't have to shout? Technician, is that possible? Can I speak with them? All right. Marvelous. Now you hear me even if I do not shout. All right. Thank you. The Jacobine educator would seek to expand his right to teach everywhere, to teach far beyond the scholastic district. He would make us depend more on planned and engineered processes in learning and deliver his services more persuasively through channels which touch us more intimately than a seat in the classroom. Media of all kinds. He would escalate the public reliance on the knowledge industry and thereby further discredit the autodidact, the self-learner. His alternative to school is the attempt to transform society into a classroom, into a school. This is a logical next step for the utopian who failed to create a new man by locking children into a planned new world of the classroom for a few thousand hours during their lifetime, and because he failed at making the new man by locking people provisionally into the new society, which is as the world should be, now tries to make the world into a classroom. The Bourbon who tries to substitute for schools
does not see any breakdown in schools. For him, the present crisis in education or in schools is the result of a rude awakening of his colleague, the Jacobine, the one who tried to compel students to compete for a treatment which would make them equals, because that's basically what school does. He wants to substitute, he, the Bourbon, the vulgar, universal schools of the Jacobine with more selective ones for the elite of his choosing. Basically, therefore, the request of deschooling at the moment is very much locked in, apprivoisé, taken over by two groups of people, Bourbons and Jacobines. Jacobines and Bourbons who want to substitute schools. Now, surprisingly, many of the most articulate Bourbons or critics of the modern school systems are in fact Bourbons. They are disenchanted school teachers who remained passionate educators at heart. They gain enthusiastic following among parents and students by pointing out that schools, as they are now, do much more damage than good, both to rich and to poor. They demand different teachers, different rules, different kinds of community control, different curricula and different tools. Their recommendations are easily co-opted, of course, into the school system, as soon as a foundation provides them with sufficient funds to conduct a school to their own ideas. A school which is frequently even more expensive than that available to everybody else. Because some of you spoke about free schools at the beginning. The fact that the pupils who are privileged to enjoy the treatment of new schools as we have them now during the last 3 years are not necessarily the dropouts from the rich who can go to Summerhill, but often an elite chosen from among the black, the poor, the urban, the Puerto Rican, makes it difficult for these critics of the school system to realize that they are basically what I called before Bourbons. The Jacobin utopian and the Bourbon dystopian share both the outlook of the school teacher. They seek new tools to perform their old profession. They claim a special competence to educate the consumer of a society which they say technological inputs inevitably will render opaque, complex, and impersonal. Now, my ideal is exactly the opposite of what they propose, both the Bourbons and the Jacobines. The Jacobines who want to transform the world into a classroom, and the Bourbons who say schools, after all, can work only for elites. I trust, and this is the point, the axiom from which I start, and which I'm not willing even to discuss, I'm willing to defend. I trust men constantly to use their hearts and their brains. I want to live in a transparent society in which each moment of life is surprising and meaningful participation in mutual education. And I want to live in mutual education up to the moment and in the moment of my death. I see human perfection in the progressive elimination of the institutional intermediary between man and the truth which he wants to learn. Schools now support the claims which give professionals the power to classify people, to set the values which people should have, to impose these values, and to take recourse to science, a science known only to them called pedagogics, which legitimizes the whole procedure, the reality to which they serve. This schooling society would transform the concept of the teaching profession, of the pedagogue, but equally any other profession. Why? The first power of the professional, namely the power to define people's needs, finds its expression in the proliferation of a school-made class system. Our subcultures of childhood, youth, or the illiterate are products of the teacher's existence. Without the teachers, we wouldn't have any youth. Or any childhood subculture. It didn't exist all through history. Equally, the teacher produces the dropout, the underdeveloped. And equally, the teacher produces the subculture of the professional as we know it today. The second power, the professional competence to declare knowledge of special value when it has been acquired in school, trains for the institutionalization not only of the value of knowing, but of any other value. Once I've accepted that my own learning is the result of teaching, I accept almost any other value as dependent on my being the client of a specialized institution. And finally, the teacher exercises the supreme authority of a professional, because the personal authority of a teacher in the classroom is supreme. He combines there the style of policeman, moralist, and therapeute, the man who tells you what you may not do otherwise you are thrown out, what you may not do because otherwise you are evil, and what you may not do otherwise you should feel frustrated, Lionel. The legitimacy of the school teacher is undermined once the need for the subculture of youth or the value of classroom and curriculum are seriously questioned. Beyond this, I just repeat for those who have not followed the whole argument, schools now serve as an overarching ritual which renders the fundamental contradictions within modern society tolerable. A man who goes to school feels that he's competing for equality. It's a very funny idea to be obligated to compete for equality. But this is what our society is built on. The myth says we can all become equal, and the social structure says he who consumes more does more social good because he increases the flow of resources. Men learn to define what they need in terms of the goods and services large institutions like the school can produce. They learn to define their own value in terms of their ability to consume and degrade these produces. A consumer is somebody who can degrade institutional value. Consume and degrade is the same concept. We have therefore come to an entirely new idolatry with the school system. The old biblical Moloch ate your kids. You took your kids and put them into the oven, the stomach of a god. We construct our own gods which produce values, goods, or services, and the good consumer can degrade these values. Man's value is measured by his ability to consume. And this is true just as much for the so-called consumer society of the West as it is true for the socialist society in the East, only that there, only the degree gives you access to high consumption of a place on the supersonic plane between Vladivostok and Moscow, when here you have to have the money for it. Now, what school does is pretty clear. How can we move away from schools? How will learning happen in a society in which we do not obligate people to go to school? Let me first describe what I mean by deschooling, then describe in a few words what legal protection a deschooled society needs, and then describe four networks of communications which would be necessary in such a society. First, what do I mean by the deschooling of society? I mean basically a mental process, a cultural revolution here. The conviction of evidence. Every child, until very recently, knew that I go to school for many reasons, most of it because I have to go there, but not because I'm learning something from my teacher. The best proof for this is if any one of you had a child, a girl who comes home week after week telling you what a fantastic teacher she has and what she learns from him, you would take her to a psychiatrist. Because you would then remember that this girl reacts entirely different from the way you reacted when you were that age. A girl, when I came in here, gave me this marvelous picture. School, she took it out from some remark I made, is a mega hygienic super womb. Because I explain hygiene as, and somebody asked me upstairs about what I learned from Fromm. This is one of the major things I learned from Erich Fromm, that hygiene and love of death, of the dead, necrophilia, are very closely related. I don't know, do you have any questions on this? Hygiene means make sure that every contact between me and in the environment be carefully planned by somebody else. And that is what happens in this classroom. The relationship between the child and his surrounding, the new society, is very carefully planned in every detail. I do think that there's a close relationship between soap and school. When North Americans always speak about drug addictions, and when I ask them what does a drug mean, they tell me a drug. A drug is a chemical which you need and which you feel come depend upon in order to feel either awake or asleep. When I say, well, in Cuernavaca I know that people, North Americans, can't wake up in the morning unless they have smeared themselves with a special preparation in the morning, which is called soap. Unless they put soap on themselves, they can't wake up. I'm just... Now, let us see. It's the fundamental drug of our society. But let me... The first step in the de-schooling of society is a conviction that learning is not the result of an institutional process of teaching. And on the part of the teacher, that the learning of people does not depend on their ability to package curricula in any specific way. That is, the inversion of school is principally a process of getting away from the idea that learning can be ever made compulsory, and therefore an attempt to provide institutions which increase the ability of contact between man and his environment. To go to the questions asked upstairs, for this we need at least three legal protections. We need a protection of the individual against the present regressive taxation which the school system imposes necessarily on the poor. I do think that the best place in the world to speak about this outside of Nyeri's Zambia and Peru, two other countries which seem as advanced as Canada, is Ontario. Because here in Ontario you are privileged to have the first very public report which states that there is just no possibility whatsoever to make post-secondary education into anything else but a regressive system of taxation as long as we keep the schools. I'm speaking here of the Wright Commission report. It's a most distasteful document because it faces facts in a way in which I'm not aware anywhere else in the English-speaking world we have been faced. Certainly, the Carnegie Commission report, on which somebody told me recently 25 times as much money was spent, didn't come out with anything similar to it. So the first guarantee is guarantee against regressive taxation by simply not supporting schools, free schools. Because in the schools, necessarily, the poor drop out earlier and receive disproportionately less economic assistance than the rich. The second important legislative proposal to make is to prohibit discrimination because of a man's learning pedigree or curriculum. At this moment, it is acceptable practice of discrimination if the two of you show up and equally well know how to do a job, automatically goes to you if you can prove that you have used $10,000 more of public funds to reach for competence, even though this is the most evident proof of your stupidity. Because either there is a relationship between your competence and the necessity you had for that money, then it's a clear proof of your stupidity. If there is no relationship, then you were simply smarter in pilfering the public treasury. The third guarantee we need is progressively the disqualification, the disestablishment, the discredit of professional accreditation. At this moment, a man may teach only if he has gone through a ritual of so many years, attending so many classes, some of his co-professional have declared as necessary. It would be much more logical to have people meet who had the advantages of getting the services of a teacher, of a doctor, of a lawyer, to discuss with each other if that guy is or is not somebody who meets your expectations. But this hits all our conception of a civilized, highly idolatric society so deeply that it is difficult to discuss in public. Because at this moment we believe that anything which is learned in order to be of value must be learned in school. It is probably for this reason that sex instruction is becoming such an important subject in schools at this moment. And at the end of the gentleman who had dinner, this question came up, and I, excuse me, but it just happened to me yesterday. An Italian diplomat said to me on the plane, in fact, in New York we don't need brothels for educational purposes. I say, why? Because we have junior high schools. Now, you can make anything depend on a certain profession in order to make it valuable. Now, the three legal bases on which deschooling must function are: one, protection against regressive taxation. The simplest two ways would be either to make whatever public resources are available for education available on an unlimited basis, or provide everybody with a minimum amount of educational entitlements, green stamps, or credit, and have him buy up to the limit of his credit in public institutions, learning centers, access which he wants. The second one is prohibiting discrimination against people because of their learning curriculum. And the third one is increasingly disestablish the power of professions to limit the civil rights, to disenfranchise human beings. Because the service profession basically lives on its publicly recognized power to define people who don't use their services as somehow not fully human beings, not equal human beings. What would the institutions look like which would provide education in a society built on the idea that men will learn if they only have access to the resources of learning, as opposed to the institution which is built on the idea that learning is the result of teaching, which is of course school. In order to speak about these institutions, I would suggest that we classify or categorize learning resources according to the difficulties or the properties we have for those who want to get access to them. At present, we classify learning resources in view of a teacher's purpose in using them in a curriculum which will lead the student to the goal the teacher has chosen. I propose to classify learning resources according to the peculiar difficulties a learner has in order to reach access to the resources he wants. Now, I think the resources needed for learning can be very easily classified as four from this point of view. Things, skill models, peers, and masters, elders. Let me say why I put them on different circuits, on different networks, into different classes. Things, in principle, don't get tired. They are available 24 hours a day. They have many other things in common. Skill models are always plentiful. People who speak French in Canada are abundant. For the moment, they can't teach French unless they are certified to do so. And the same thing is true for English speakers, for auto mechanics, for people who know to do your job or your job. But quite evidently, our sound man, our TV operator, or our French teachers who might be in the audience would be seriously threatened if suddenly we discredited their teaching certificates. Peers, to discuss an issue, to raise a question, will exist only when I can find them, because the fact that today I would be interested to discuss with somebody else Bruce Rusk's last article doesn't mean that the day after tomorrow I still would be interested in it. And it's a problem, how do I find today the man with whom I can discuss this article? Well, masters can't be paid for. You can only see how you motivate them to grant up their time. Let me speak of these four basic networks of learning resources a little bit further in detail. Things are necessary for acquiring learning. At this moment we say that poor people have relatively limited access to things, and we try to increase the amount of things which are available in the classroom. But basically, if society will not be educational, before we render all things and processes in society accessible, transparent, luminous, so that they don't hide their secret anymore in themselves. I took into my hands this machine just before I came up here, sitting down there, and on the back side of that recorder is written, "Do not tamper or attempt to repair this mechanism. No user repairable items contained." This is true of the way how we construct most modern things, and this is very recently new in society. I question very seriously if the possible economic advantages, economy per piece, which we obtain this way, are in any relation to the deprivation of educational abilities of things which we thus produce. One of the first rules, therefore, I would make in order to make things again educational: radically deny the ability of individuals or institutions to control or restrict the educational use of things which for production purposes in some way we do control. I do think that this would be a much more radical approach to move into a society in which private property has an entirely different meaning from that which it has today than the usual political or economic approach. At the same time, I would insist that things which are made specifically for learning, museums or baseball bats in schools, games or lab equipment, at this moment are made highly expensive by their administration through teachers and school administrators, inaccessible, gain the odium of the pupil because they are used as curricular implements in an obligatory learning process, and are not available. That therefore, this schooling in relation to things means, on the one hand, rendering the world more transparent, and second, building bridges for all people to the things from which we can learn. Skill exchange. In Latin America, at least, I can say that there are no scarce skills which are not made scarce artificially. As soon as there is the demand for a skill in a community to repair radios or cars or anything else, there are some people around who have the skill. But as the pedagogue moves into Latin America, he tells us increasingly that the fact that somebody has a competence does not yet qualify him in order to teach that competence. We must find a way in which we can make the exchange of skills a basic, not only obligation, but vocation of everybody. People do learn the most complex skills by simple exchange of speech with their parents or siblings. Why can't they learn in Canada, in the United States, driving the same way? 20 years ago in Europe, people still, or 10 years ago, put into their curriculum vitae, among the things they know how to do, I know how to drive a car. Anybody of you who would put into curriculum vitae, I have a driver's license, would make himself somewhat ridiculous. But only 20 years earlier, I remember still my uncle, he was known as a gentleman driver, because quite frequently he put the chauffeur next to him and drove the car. At that time, driving a car was a highly complicated profession, and it was much less dangerous and much less complex a skill than it has to become today, because then the highest speed possible was about 40 miles an hour. Therefore, the development of skill exchanges is the second major request for institutions which would function for access to learning resources in a de-schooled society. The third one, quite distinct again, as I said, are peer matching networks. They can work on many different levels. I've discussed them elsewhere, so in the question period we might go into it. Most people who have acquired a skill to a certain level of competence need to exercise it with somebody else, either because they want to use it for a creative purpose or because they want to practice it further. These skills can be speaking a foreign language, playing at a game, building boats or huts, engaging in social work of any kind. We have at this moment no ways of getting such people easily together. I don't see any reason why in Toronto there shouldn't be a universally serviceable peer matching system in form of 600 typewriter outlets into which you can put your name and the skill for which you seek a companion, and within 3 seconds the typewriter answers you. People who have requested peers for the same skill are the following, and it types it out and gives you the addresses and telephone numbers. I do believe, first of all, that universities practically could be done away with if we had such a skill, a peer matching system in operation. Finally, how would we find access to the masters and teachers in a society if we disestablish schools, as more formally disestablished the church, and create a society which cannot depend on credentials? I do believe that, again, a peer matching system or network is absolutely necessary, because it is the only way in which peers who want to get together in order to find out to whom they believe one can take recourse as a teacher should take recourse.